Chapter 14. That night he took her to dinner, and four nights later, on Saturday, he took her with him to a wholesaler's party in San Francisco. As the two of them drove up the peninsula, Marianne asked, "Does this car belong to you?"
"I bought this Dodge back in 48. A package deal. It came along with Max."
He added, "I gave up heavy driving." His eyes had become bad, and he had one night hit a parked milk truck. He didn't tell the girl that. "It's a nice car. It's so big and quiet." She watched the dark fields passing on either side of the highway. "What will this party be like?"
"You're not scared, are you?"
"No," she said, sitting very upright beside him, her hands around her purse. She had put on what looked to him like a pair of black silk pajamas. The trousers were tied around her bare ankles, and the shirt flared out into a great pointed collar. On her feet were little flat slippers, and her hair was tied back in a foreshortened ponytail. As she had skipped out of her apartment house and into the car, he had observed,
"Your hair is too short for a ponytail."
Breathlessly, she had settled beside him and slammed the car door. "Is this too arty? Am I dressed wrong?"
"You look wonderful," he had said, in all honesty, as he started up the car.
But she was, in spite of what she said, a little frightened. In the gloom of the car, her eyes were large and serious, and she had almost nothing to say. Once she got her cigarettes from her purse and bent toward the dashboard lighter.
"This may be fun," he said, to cheer her up.
"That's what you told me."
"Leland Partridge is a fanatic, what we call an audiophile. There'll be speakers as large as houses, diamond cartridges, hi-fi recordings of freight trains and glockenspiels."
"Will there be very many people there?" she asked again for the third time.
"People from retail, plus some of the San Francisco musical crowd. There'll be drinks and plenty of talk. You may hear some good arguments when the sound boys and the legitimate musicians tangle."
"I love San Francisco," Marianne said with ardor. "All those tiny bars and restaurants. Once I went to a place out in North Beach with Tweeny, something called the Paper Doll. We heard a Dixieland pianist. He was cool."
"Cool," Schilling echoed, grimacing.
"He was quite good." She tapped her cigarette with her finger. Sparks swept out the window into the darkness. From the car radio filtered the sounds of a Haydn symphony. "I like that," she said, inclining her head.
"Do you recognize it?"
She meditated. "Beethoven."
"It's the Haydn drum roll symphony."
"Do you think I'll ever learn to tell what a piece is? Will I be as old as you?"
"You're learning," he said, as lightly as possible. "It's a question of experience, nothing more."
"You really love that music. I've watched you. You're not pretending. It's the same way Paul is about his music. You sort of drink it up. You try to get all of it."
"I like your friend Nitz," he said, although in some ways he was disturbed by the man.
"Yes, he's a lovely person. I don't believe he could ever do anybody harm."
"You admire that?"
"Yes," she said. "Don't you?"
"I admire it in the abstract."
"Oh, you and your abstract." She settled in a heap against the door, her legs drawn up under her, one arm resting on the windowsill. "What are those lights up there?" She sounded apprehensive. "Are we almost there?"
"Almost. Pull your courage together."
"It's together. Don't make fun of me."
"I'm not making fun of you," he said gently. "Why should I make fun of you?"
"Will they all laugh at what I say?"
"Of course not."
He couldn't help adding,
"They'll be making so much racket with their sound effects records, they won't hear what you say."
"I don't feel good."
"You'll feel better when we get there," he assured her with fatherly sympathy, speeding up the car.
The party was already in progress when they arrived. Schilling noted the transformation in the girl as she climbed the steps to Partridge's house. Her fear vanished below the surface. Face impassive, she lounged against the iron railing of the porch, purse in one hand, the other hand draped over her trousered knee. As soon as the door opened, she slipped to her feet and passed by the man at the entrance. She had already gone into the hall and was approaching the living room full of noise and laughter when Schilling stubbed out his cigar and stepped inside.
"Hello, Leland," he said to his host, shaking hands. "What became of my girl?"
"There she goes," Partridge said, closing the door. He was a tall, middle-aged man with glasses. "Wife? Mistress?"
"Counter girl."
Schilling removed his overcoat.
"How's the family?"
"About the same." Arm on Schilling's shoulder, he led him into the living room. "Earl has a cold again. It's the same flu we all got last year. How's the store?"
"Can't complain."
They both stopped to watch Marianne.
she had picked out Edith Partridge and was accepting a drink from her hostess's tray. Apparently at ease, Marianne turned to meet a band of young record clerks grouped around a table. On the table was a display of sound components, turntables, cartridges, tone arms, elements of the diatonic binaural system. "She's got savoir faire," Partridge said. "For a girl that young, it's unusual. My oldest is about her age." "Mary," Schilling said, "stroll over and meet your host." She did so, and the introductions were made. "Who's that terribly fat man?" she asked Partridge. "Over in the corner there, sprawled on the couch." "That?" Partridge smiled at Schilling. "That's a terribly fat composer named Sid Hethel. Go over and listen to him wheeze. He's worth hearing." "That's the first I've heard you admit that about Sid," Schilling said. He always found Partridge a shade offensive. "His conversation is exquisite," Partridge said dryly. "It's a pity he didn't decide to go into literature." "Do you want to meet him?" Schilling asked Marianne. "He's an experience, even if you don't care for his music." Accompanied by Partridge, they made their way over. "What's his music like?" Marianne asked nervously. "Very sentimental," Partridge declared, his beaked face rising above her as he steered the two of them between the groups of people. "Somewhat like a breakfast of maraschino cherries." Over the mutter of voices roared the titanic Mahler Symphony No. 1, amplified by the network of horns and speakers mounted throughout the large, well-furnished living room. "What Leland means," Schilling said, "is that Hethel hasn't run out of melody as his compatriots have." "Ah," Partridge said, "how it takes me back to hear you talk, Joe. The good old days when a little man used to run out at the beginning of each record and shout the name of the selection." Sid Hethel was involved in conversation. Legs stuck out, cane resting against his fleshy groin. He was jabbing a ponderous finger at his circle of listeners. Hethel was a continent of tissue. From deep fat, his eyes, black and sharp, peered out. It was the Hethel that Schilling remembered. He had, to accommodate his belly, unsnapped the two top buttons of his fly. "Oh, no," Hethel was sputtering, wiping his mouth with a wad of white handkerchief, which he held in his hand close to his chin. "You've got me wrong. I never said anything like that. Frankenstein's a good reviewer, a good music reviewer, the best in the area. But he's a chauvinist. If you're local talent, you're the cream of the crop. If you're Lily Lombino from Wheeling, West Virginia, however, you can play the violin like Sarasate, and Alf won't give you a tumble." "I hear music and art reviewing don't keep him occupied," a member of Hethel's circle supplied. "He's going to kick out Kaltanowski into the chess column." "Chess," Hethel said. "This is possible. With Alf Frankenstein, it could be everything but cooking." He caught sight of Partridge, and a wicked gleam sparkled in his eyes. "Now, this binaural business, if only Mahler were alive today." "With binaural," Partridge broke in gravely, "Mahler would have been able to listen to his music as it really sounded." "You have a point," Hethel conceded, turning his attention to his host. "Of course, we must remember that to Mahler, his music sounded good. Is there a knob or a dial on your system that makes Mahler sound good? Because if there is..." "Sid," Schilling said, feeling the potency of their years of friendship, "you realize you're drinking Leland's liquor and you're insulting him at the same time." "If I wasn't drinking his liquor," Hethel said rapidly, "I wouldn't be insulting anybody. What brings you up here, Joss? Still trying to put Maurice Ravel under contract?" His vast, pulpy hands, both of them, snaked out. Schilling accepted them, and the two men gripped each other warmly. "It's good to see you," Hethel said, equally moved. "Still carry a box of contraceptives around in your briefcase?" "What you call a briefcase," Schilling said, "is a large, leather, custom-appointed douchebag." "Once," Hethel confided to his group, "I saw Joss Schilling sitting in a bar..." His voice trailed off. "Good God, Schilling, I want to see the woman who goes with that douchebag." A little embarrassed, Schilling glanced at Marianne. How was she weathering the spectacle of Sid Hethel, the great contemporary composer? Standing with her arms folded, she listened and did not seem amused nor offended. It was impossible to tell what she thought. Her face was expressionless. In her black silk trousers, she was remarkably slender. There was balance in her straight back and elongated neck, and above her folded arms, her breasts were very small, very sharp, quite visibly up-tilted. "Sid," Schilling said, bringing the girl forward, "I've opened a little new record shop down in Pacific Park. Remember I always wanted to? One day when I pried up the lid of a shipping carton, this elf popped out. "My dear," Heffel said to her, the banter all at once gone from his voice, "step over here and tell me why you're working in that old man's record shop." He put his hand out and closed his fingers around hers. "What's your name?" She told him quietly, with the innate dignity Schilling had come to expect of her. "Don't be elusive," Heffel said, smiling around at the circle of people. "Doesn't she look elusive to you?" "What's that mean?" Marianne asked him. Heffel scowled. "Mean?" He sounded baffled. "Well," he said in a cross, overly loud voice, "it means..." He turned to Schilling. "Tell her what it means."
"He means you're a very pretty little girl," Edith Partridge said, appearing with a tray of drinks. "Who's run dry?"
"Here," Heffel muttered, groping at the tray for a glass. "Thanks, Edith."
He focused his attention on her, letting go of Marianne's hand.
"How are the kids?"
"How does he strike you?" Schilling asked the girl as he maneuvered her back through the ring of people, away from Heffel.
"He didn't upset you, did he?"
"No," she said, shaking her head.
"He's had too much to drink, as usual. You find him repulsive?"
"No," she said. "He's like Nitz, isn't he? I mean, he's not like most people. Whatever it is about them, the hard part, the part I'm afraid of. I wasn't afraid of him."
"Sid Heffel is the gentlest man in the world."
He was gratified by her reaction.
"Can I get you anything?"
"No, thanks." Suddenly, with a rush of pessimism, she said, "They all can tell how old I am, can't they?"
"How old are you?"
"I'm young."
"That's good. Think of yourself and then think of us. Partridge and Heffel and Schilling, three old daughterers, reminiscing about the days of the cylinder record."
"I wish I could talk about that," Marianne said fervently. "What have I got to say? All I can do is tell people my name. Isn't that wonderful?"
"It's good enough for me," he said, and meant it.
"Do you know who Mio is?"
"Yes," he admitted. She wandered away from him, and after some hesitation, he followed. Now she had halted at the edge of a group of audio engineers and was listening to their conversation. Her face was drawn up in the troubled frown he was beginning to know. "Marianne," he said, "they're comparing the roll-off of the new Bogan and Fisher amplifiers. What do you care about that?"
"I don't even understand what it is."
"It's sound, and sometimes I wonder if they understand." He led her over to a window seat in the deserted corner of the room and sat her down. She held onto her glass. Edith Partridge had taken her purse and stared at the floor. "Cheer up," he said.
"What's that awful racket?"
He listened. All he could hear was the noise of human voices and, of course, the torrent of Mahler's symphonic texture. "That must be it. There's a speaker horn mounted near here." He felt around with his hands until he located a grill set in the wall behind a print. "See? It's emerging from that."
"Does it have a name?"
"Yes, it's the Mahler First Symphony."
Marianne brooded. "You even know the name. Would you teach me that?"
"Of course." He felt sad and touched.
"Because," Marianne went on earnestly, "I want to talk to that man, and I can't. That fat man?"
She shook her head.
"I guess I'm tired, all those people coming in and out of the store today. What time is it?"
"It was only 9:30. "Want to leave?" he asked.
"No, that wouldn't be right."
"It's up to you," he said, meaning it.
"Where would we go, back?"
"If you want."
"I don't want."
"Well," he said softly, "then we won't. We could go to a bar. We could go get something to eat. We could simply walk around San Francisco. We could do any number of things."
"Could we ride on a cable car?"
she asked in a wan, discouraged whisper. At the far end of the room, an argument had broken out. Angry voices burst through the curtain of symphonic sound. It was Partridge and Heffel. "Let's try to be rational about this," Partridge was complaining in his scolding voice. "I agree that we have to keep means and ends clear, but sound is not a means and music the end. Music is a value term applied to recognized patterns of sound. What you call sound is simply music you don't like, and furthermore, Heffel's response boomed out, "if I kick over a stack of bottles twice in succession, I'm entitled to claim I've composed something called a study in glass. Is that it? Isn't that what you're saying?"
"There's no need to make a personal attack out of this."
Turning his back on Heffel, Partridge flounced off, smiling in a set, mechanical fashion, going from group to group, saying hello and greeting people. The talk and music gradually resumed. Ethel, surrounded by his ring of neophytes, ceased to be audible.
God, Partridge breathed, approaching Schilling and Marianne. He's drunk, of course. I should have known better.
Schilling said, known better than to invite him. The characteristic sound of a piano rose up. Somebody was starting to play. Partridge's exasperation boiled up anew.
Damn him, that's Ethel. He finally found the piano. I told Edith to get it completely out of the house.
That's pretty hard to do, Schilling said, feeling scant sympathy for the man, unless you have plenty of notice.
I'll have to stop him. He's ruining the entire thing.
What entire thing?
The demonstration, of course. We're here to inaugurate a new dimension in sound. I don't intend to permit his infantile...
Sid Ethel, Schilling said, plays the piano in public on the average of once a year. I can name a few students in composition who would give their right eyes to be here.
That's my point. He's picked this time on purpose. Of course he doesn't play in public. How did he get over to the piano? The man's so obese he can scarcely stagger.
Come on, Schilling said, bending over Marianne. This is unique. You won't have this opportunity again.
I wish Paul was here, she said, as they pushed over. An eagerness had set in among the guests. Men and women, forgetting their talk, strained close to see. Standing on tiptoe, those in back succeeded in catching a glimpse of the great mound of flesh slouched at the keyboard.
Here, Schilling said, I'll boost you up.
He caught hold of the girl around her waist. She was slim, very slim, and firm. His hands passed almost around her as he lifted her up against him, raising her until she could see over the ring of heads.
Oh, she said. Oh, Joseph, look at him.
When the playing had finished, Ethel soon ran out of breath. The crowd dispersed and flowed off. Her face flushed, Marianne trailed after Schilling.
Paul should have seen this, she said wistfully. I wish we could have brought him. Wasn't he wonderful? And he looked as if he was asleep. His eyes were shut, weren't they? And those big fingers, how did he manage it? How could he play the keys?
Over in the corner, Sid Ethel sat gasping, his face mottled and dark. He hardly glanced up as Schilling and Marianne appeared in front of him.
Thanks, Schilling said to the man.
Why? Ethel wheezed, but he seemed to understand. Well, at least I interfered with the future of binaural sound.
It was worth coming, Marianne said to him quickly. I never heard anybody play like that.
What sort of store is this? Ethel demanded, coughing into his handkerchief. You used to be in publishing, Joshua, with Shermer.
I left them a long time ago, Schilling said. For a while I was in wholesale records. I prefer this. In my own store I can talk to people as much as I want.
Yes, you always love to waste time. I suppose you still have your damn record collection. All those Deutsche Grammophones and Polydors. And that girl we liked to listen to back in the old days. What was her name?
Elizabeth Schumann, Schilling said, remembering.
Yes, the one who sang like a child. I never forgot her.
I wish, Schilling said, I could get you down to see my place.
A store? We've got stores up here.
I've been trying to stir some sort of interest in music down there. Every Sunday I have open house, records and coffee.
You desire me to die? Ethel demanded. I'd travel down there and expire.
You remember what happened that time in Washington when I fell getting off the train? You remember how long I was laid up?
I've got a car. I'll drive you both ways. You can sleep the whole trip.
Ethel reflected.
You'll hit bumps, he decided. You'll pick up bumps and run over them. I know you.
On my word of honor.
Really? Let's have that good old Boy Scout oath. In these times of shifting moral values, there's got to be something stable we can count on.
Ethel's eyes gleamed with nostalgia. Remember the time you and I got lost in that Chinese whorehouse on Grand Avenue? And you got drunk and tried to...
Seriously, Schilling said, not wishing such topics discussed before Marianne.
Seriously, I'll have to mull it over. I want to get out of the Bay Area. This parochial climate is murder. I could come and dazzle people. Maybe between us we could lick the sound boys.
He patted Schilling on the arm. I'll call you, Josh. It depends on how I feel.
Goodbye, Marianne said as she and Schilling started away.
Ethel opened his tired eyes. Goodbye, little Miss Elf. Josh Schilling's elusive elf. I remember you.
The party was breaking up. A few scattered people were gathered around Partridge's hi-fi examining the diatronic binaural sound system, but the majority had drifted off.
You want to go? Schilling said to the girl.
Maybe so.
You feel better, don't you?
Yes, she she said, and shivered.
Cold?
Just tired. Maybe you could get me my purse. I think she put it in the bedroom. He went to get her purse and his own overcoat. In a moment, they had said good evening to the Partridges and were starting down the front steps onto the sidewalk. "Boo," Marianne said, jumping into the car. "I'm freezing." He started the motor and clicked on the heater.
"You want to go back? Tomorrow's Sunday. You don't have to get up early."
Restlessly, Marianne said, "I don't want to go back. Maybe we could go somewhere."
But she looked tired and drawn. A scrawny, almost gaunt quality had crept up into the hollows of her face. "I'll take you home," Schilling decided. "It's time you were in bed." Without protest, she sank down against the seat, brought up her knees, and pressed her chin into the fabric. Arms folded, she stared at the steering column. Once, as they drove along the peninsula highway between towns, Marianne lifted her head and murmured,
"If he does come down, Paul could hear him."
"Absolutely," he agreed.
"Did he write some of the music Paul listened to in the booth that day?"
"I gave Paul one of Hethel's pieces, yes, a sonata for a small chamber orchestra, his rustic sonata."
"You told me sonatas were for piano."
"Most of them, but not with Sid Hethel."
"Jesus," Marianne sighed. "It's so darn confusing. I'll never get it."
"Don't worry about it."
The girl lapsed into silence.
"Still cold?" he asked presently.
"No, but I should have worn a coat, only I wanted you to see my outfit. Do you like it?"
"It's fine," he said, as he had said before. "It's just right."
She became despondent again. "Wednesday is the inquest, or whatever they call it."
"What inquest?"
"For Danny Coombs. I have to go down and explain what happened so they'll know if they want to arrest anybody."
"Will they want to?"
"No, because it was an accident. Coombs ran out and fell. There was a laundry delivery man who saw him. It seems so remote. But it was only a couple of weeks ago. Now it sounds like something I made up. Except that if we don't say the right thing, Tweeny will go to the flea bee." Her voice trailed off.
"You don't want him to be tried?"
"Of course not. Well, they won't. He's strutting around. He got rid of Coombs. Now he has a free field with Beth. Good for him."
With a sigh, she rolled herself up in a ball and lay back against the seat. In a few moments, she had drifted off into a troubled doze.
When he brought the car to a halt in front of her apartment building, she was still asleep. She didn't stir as he shut off the motor and pushed open the door. He had already begun to gather her up before she blinked and opened her eyes.
"What are you doing?" she asked wearily.
"Going to carry me inside?"
"Do you mind?"
"I guess not," she yawned. "But be careful. Don't kill yourself."
She weighed, he discovered, about as much as 4 cartons of records, probably not much more than 100 pounds. Without difficulty, he pushed open the front door of the building and carried her upstairs. Here and there, light showed under doors, but her own apartment was dark, and the door, when he tried the knob, was locked.
"I have the key," she murmured, "in my purse. Set me down and I'll get it."
He set her down, stumbling a little. She leaned against the door, eyes half shut. Presently she smiled, opened her purse, and groped inside it.
"Thank you for the nice time," she said.
"That's perfectly all right."
"We went out together, didn't we?"
"I suppose so. Did you have fun?"
"I wish..." Again she yawned, showing her small white teeth and pink cat's tongue. "I wish I could have understood more. Will we ever see that fat man again, Sid Hethel? Will he come down here?"
"Maybe. I hope so."
Putting his hands on her shoulders, his fingers touching her neck, he bent over her and kissed her close to the mouth. She gave a little soundless cry of surprise and wonder. One hand came up in a gesture of defense as if she intended to scratch him. Whatever it was, she changed her mind. For an interval, she leaned drowsily against him, clinging to him in her half-sleep. Then, all at once, she was awake. She had reached some kind of decision. Her body stiffened, and she pulled back.
"No,"
she said, slipping away from him, out from under his hands, becoming shadowy and insubstantial in the gloom of the hall.
"No what?" he echoed, not understanding.
"We can't go in there. She's in there."
Taking hold of his hand, Marianne led him back along the hall, away from the locked door of her apartment.